got a sprain or an itch, pain, rash, swelling, or twitch, call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky. I call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining.
I love Paris in the springtime.
I Love Paris. What a great song.
It was written by Cole Porter, 1953, and introduced by Lilo in the musical Can Can, and it became a hit in 1953 by Lex Baxter and his orchestra. It has been sung by no less than 40 singers, including Bing Crosby, Ella Fitzgerald, that's the clip I just played, The Coasters, and 22 others. My favorite version being sung by Screamin' Jay Hawkins, and that was released in 1958. The song again, I Love Paris. And the sights include the Louvre, the Eiffel Tower, Versailles, and of course, the famous Moulin Rouge. But these are not the parasites that we're going to talk about today. This is, after all, a show about medical and health topics. So the parasites we will be reviewing are those that affect our body, such as Chagas disease, cysticercosis, toxocara, toxoplasma, and trichomoniasis. And we're going to start with one parasitic disease most have actually heard of, and that's malaria.
Now, most people still think parasites may be acquired only in developing and third world countries, or may be picked up by the U.S. citizen on vacation.
However, a new report from the Center for Disease Control finds that malaria is very much alive in the United States. Millions of Americans get parasitic infection, and their symptoms, unfortunately, often go unnoticed or even misdiagnosed. These microscopic creatures are typically picked up through food and water. An infection can lead to serious health problems, including seizures, blindness, pregnancy complications, heart failure, and even death.
Luckily, nowadays, it's actually possible to prevent and even treat infections caused by these parasites.
So how do you know if you have one? First of all, parasites can usually be detected with a blood test or through stool analysis and can be treated with antiparasitic drugs or antibiotics. Malaria is a serious and sometimes fatal disease and is caused by a parasite that commonly infects a certain type of mosquito which feeds on humans. People who get malaria are typically very sick with high fevers, shaking chills, and even just flu-like illnesses. Although malaria can be a deadly disease, illness and death from malaria can usually be prevented.
There may be no symptoms or very mild symptoms, but could include death. So, malaria is a curable disease if it's diagnosed and treated promptly and correctly.
When the parasite develops in the red blood cells, waste substances and other toxic factors accumulate in the infected red blood cell. The toxic factors stimulate the macrophages in our bodies and other cells to produce something called cytokines, which act to produce fever and trembling, as well as the other severe pathologies that are associated with malaria.
The infected red blood cells stick to the walls of the veins and do not freely circulate in the blood. When this occurs in the vessels of the brain, it is believed to be a factor in causing the severe disease syndrome known as cerebral malaria, which is associated with high mortality.
After the bite by the Anopheles mosquito, a period of time, around 7 to 30 days, can go by. This is called the incubation period. Now, it's important to know that the anti-malarial drugs that can be taken by travelers for malaria prevention can delay the appearance of malaria symptoms by weeks and even months. The liver stages of the disease may reactivate and cause disease months after the infective mosquito has bitten you.
Because of this delay of the start of symptoms, there is often a period of misdiagnosis or delayed diagnosis. Usually the malaria attack lasts for 6 to 10 hours and consists of a cold stage where there may be shivering, or a hot stage with fever, headaches, vomiting, seizures in young children. And finally, a sweating stage where the symptoms include sweat return to normal. temperatures, and tiredness.
Usually these attacks occur every 2, 3, or 4 days, depending on the type of malarial parasite. Now, in countries where cases of malaria are infrequent, such as the U.S., these symptoms may be attributed to influenza, a cold, or other common infections, especially if malaria is not even suspected. There may also be enlarged spleen or liver and mild jaundice.
The diagnosis of malaria depends on the demonstration of parasite in the blood, usually by microscopy. Additional laboratory findings may include mild anemia, mild decrease in blood platelets called thrombocytopenia, elevation of bilirubin, an elevation of aminotransferases.
Worst case scenario is severe malaria, which occurs when infections are complicated by serious organ failure or abnormalities in the patient's blood or metabolism. The manifestations of severe malaria include cerebral malaria with abnormal behavior, impairment of consciousness, seizures, coma, and other neurologic abnormalities, as well as severe anemia, acute respiratory distress, and symptoms due to an inflammatory reaction in the lungs that inhibits oxygen exchange, and also abnormalities in blood coagulation. Now, there can also be kidney injury, and other serious problems include metabolic acidosis and low blood glucose.
So severe malaria is a medical emergency and should be treated urgently and aggressively. Treatment of malaria depends on many factors, including the disease severity, the species of malaria parasite causing the infection, and the part of the world in which the infection was acquired.
Patients who have severe malaria or who cannot take oral medication should be given the treatment by continuous IV or intravenous infusion. Most drugs used in the treatment are active against the parasitic form in the blood. That's the form that actually causes the disease. And this includes drugs such as chloroquine, malarone, Coartem, mefloquine, quinine, doxycycline when it's used in combination with quinine, and clindamycin or tetracycline, also used in combination with quinine, as well as primaquine and tafenoquine that can be used, are active against the dormant parasite liver forms to prevent relapses of the disease.
Primaquine and tafenoquine should not be taken by pregnant women or by people who are deficient in G6PD or glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase.
Patients should not take primaquine or tafenoquine until a quantitative test has excluded G6PD deficiency. Now, around 1,700 cases of malaria are diagnosed in the United States each year. And as we said, most cases in the United States are in travelers and immigrants returning from countries where malaria transmission occurs, such as sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. Now we get to Chagas disease. You know there are more than 300,000 Americans that are infected with Trypanosoma cruzi. That's the parasite that causes Chagas disease.
And there are more than 300 infected babies born every year. Chagas disease is transmitted through a bite from something called a trichomine bug, which then deposits its feces in the skin opening.
Chagas disease can cause long-term digestive, cardiac, and neurological complications, and death from the infection is often caused by heart attacks. However, if caught early, the condition is easily cured with medication, and the treatment focuses on killing the parasite and managing the signs and symptoms of the disease.
During the acute phase of Chagas disease, the prescription medication, benzonidazole and nifurtimox, may be of benefit.
But nifurtimox is not currently FDA approved. Both drugs are available in the regions most affected by Chagas disease. But in the U.S., the drug can only be obtained through the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. Once Chagas disease reaches the chronic phase, medication simply won't cure the disease. But the drugs may be offered to people younger than age 50 because they may help slow the progression of the disease and its most serious complication.
If there are heart problems associated with the disease, then treatment may include medications, a pacemaker, or other devices to regulate your heart rhythm, surgery, or even a heart transplant.
If there are digestive-related complications, then treatment may include diet modification, medications, corticosteroids, or in severe cases, surgery. Now, the final one that we're going to talk about today is cysticercosis. This parasitic infection is caused by the parasite Tenia solium. It's a tapeworm, and it makes its home in human tissues, such as the brain and muscles. Larval cysts from the parasitic form in the body can cause a number of complications, including seizures.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 29 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care. Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show.
Carmen and I are now going to continue talking about the parasite cysticercosis.
There are at least 1,000 hospitalizations for cysticercosis per year in the U.S. This tapeworm infection is often the result of eating uncooked pork that contains larval cysts.
Cysticercosis is a parasitic tissue infection, and it's caused by larval cysts, as we said, of the tapeworm Tenia solium. Now, these larval cysts can infect brain, muscle, or other tissues, and are a major cause of adult-onset seizures in many low-income countries. A person gets cysticercosis by swallowing eggs found in the feces of a person who has an intestinal tapeworm. People living in the same household with someone who has a tapeworm have a much higher risk of getting cysticercosis than people who don't.
People do not simply get cysticercosis by eating undercooked pork. Eating undercooked pork can result in intestinal tapeworm if the pork contains larval cysts. Pigs become infected by eating tapeworm eggs in the feces of the human infected with a tapeworm.
Both the tapeworm infection, also known as teniasis, and cysticercosis occur globally. The highest rate of infection are found in areas in Latin America, Asia, and Africa that have poor sanitation and free-ranging pigs that have access to human feces. Although uncommon, cysticercosis can occur in people who have never traveled outside the United States. For example, a person infected with a tapeworm who does not wash his or her hands might accidentally contaminate food with tapeworm eggs while preparing it for others.
In the United States, cysticercosis is considered one of the neglected parasitic infections, a group of five parasitic diseases that have been targeted by CDC for public health action.
The treatment of cysticercosis really depends on various factors. This includes the individual symptoms, the location and number of the cysticerci, and the stage of cyst development. Now, generally speaking, treatment is tailored to each individual patient and their particular presentation. And the treatment regimens may include anti-helminthic agents, those are agents that are against the parasite itself, corticosteroids, anticonvulsant medications, and may include surgery.
Asymptomatic patients may not require any treatment at all. Controversy does exist as to which patients require treatment with the various medications.
Active teniasis can be treated with praziquantel, called biltricide, or niclosamide. Now, praziquantel should be used with caution if there is any possibility of neurocysticercosis, as it can actually cause inflammation around the dying cysts. For cysticercosis, the most commonly used antihelminthic agent, and that is albendazole or albenza, is used, as well as praziquantel. These antiparasitic medications are effective in eliminating the viable cysticerci, though they could cause reactive localized inflammation.
Corticosteroids may also be used in conjunction with or instead of antiparasitic medication. However, corticosteroids are used to decrease inflammation but are not active against the parasite.
Again, remember, treatment with these medications will always be tailored to each individual case. Anticonvulsant medications are used in patients with neurocysticercosis who are experiencing seizures or are at high risk for recurrent seizures. Various anticonvulsant medications, you may have heard of them, Tegretol or Phenytoin, that's Dilantin, may be prescribed.
Surgical management may also be necessary in select cases of cysticercosis. Surgical removal of central nervous system cyst or placement of a brain shunt to relieve pressure is sometimes necessary in some cases of neurocysticercosis.
Certain cases of cysticercosis can actually involve the eyes, or subcutaneous cysts may also require surgery, and that means an ophthalmic surgeon. About 13.9% of the U.S. population actually has antibodies against this parasitic infection. Sadly, the rest of us are at risk for acquiring it through roundworms, often found in the intestines of dogs and cats.
About 14% of Americans have had exposure to Toxocara, and at least 70 people die from the infection each year.
According to the CDC, most of the infections are in children, and many suffer blindness due to related eye disease. Now, we got some time, so let's do one more parasite, often called the cat poop parasite, or Toxoplasma gondii. It's frequently caused by close contact with our friendly felines. And in the U.S., more than 60 million people are chronically infected with Toxoplasma gondii. Now, that bears importance to repeat. More than 60 million people are chronically infected with this Toxoplasma gondii.
The parasite is also found in undercooked meat and even some unwashed fruits and vegetables.
So wash your fruits and vegetables before eating them and cook your meats well. This is especially important in pregnant women since it can put pregnant women at risk for birth defects. Let's get to the symptoms of Toxoplasma. These include swollen lymph nodes, muscle aches, and eye complications. And if it's left untreated, these problems can actually become chronic. In other words, long-term problems.
Most healthy people don't require toxoplasmosis treatment, but if you are otherwise healthy and have signs and symptoms of acute toxoplasmosis, your doctor may prescribe pyrimethamine or daraprim, which is typically used for malaria and is a folic acid antagonist.
It may prevent your body from absorbing the B vitamin folate, so your doctor could recommend actually giving you additional folic acid. There are other potential side effects of pyrimethamine, and these include bone marrow suppression and liver toxicity. Sulfadiazine is an antibiotic, and it's used with pyrimethamine to treat the toxoplasmosis. The treatment is different, though, in pregnant women, and of course it's vital that any pregnant woman with the symptoms should immediately see her gynecologist. You know, we started the talk today with malaria. As we said, if left untreated, malaria can be deadly.
However, the Plasmodium parasite has a problem, and that is to complete its life cycle, it must eventually be acquired by another mosquito, which occurs when the insect bites an infected person.
This particular pathogen elicits a strong odor during reproduction phase.
So, in a new study, researchers showed that whether mosquitoes find the right victim to bite is not left to chance by the pathogen. Instead, the Plasmodium parasite appears to manipulate its host by changing the characteristics of the infected individual's body odor, which makes the carrier more attracted to hungry mosquitoes.
It happens that the malaria pathogens alter the level of compounds already present in the scent of uninfected individuals. There appears to be an overall elevation of several compounds that are attractive to mosquitoes. So infected people smell more attractive, but do not form highly specific body odors, especially given that the malaria pathogen can also have adverse effects on mosquitoes. One problem, in fact, is that the malaria infection leaves its mark on body odor for life.
In addition to aiding efforts to disrupt malaria transmission by mosquitoes, the researchers hope that findings from this work may also be used to develop new non-invasive diagnostic procedures that would facilitate effective screening of human populations for malaria infections.
Before we end, we'd like to tell you about a possible new product or compound that may offer lasting non-opioid pain relief. It's a new formulation, but it's a formulation of a commonly used pain medicine that appears to offer longer and stronger relief after surgery than the previous version.
The compound combines the local anesthetic bupivacaine with a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, the NSAID meloxicam.
You know that the opioid crisis has caught the nation's attention, and policies are often driven in the direction of reducing opioids and levying punishment for past wrongs. The unintended consequence is that there are more deaths from illicit drugs that have filled the void of fewer prescribed opioids. There are multiple anecdotes about pain patients on opioid therapy who are abandoned by their caregivers, their providers, and who subsequently turn to illicit opioids or even suicide as a way out.
A lack of focus on this central capstone of trauma will continue a cycle of unintended consequences as one drug crisis replaces another.
What started in the media as an opioid crisis quickly became known as a prescription drug epidemic. Now, this change in name or nomenclature changed as the guidelines, education, and other regulatory measures led to a decrease in the amount of prescription opioids throughout the country. Heroin and the fentanyl derivatives, which you may have heard about, replaced these prescribed opioids, and the death toll from suspected opioid overdoses rose quickly. So the United States traded its controlled drugs for more dangerous illicit drugs.
Over time, the autopsies demonstrated a fundamental truth. Most people were dying from a combination of drugs and rarely, if ever, just one opioid.
In eastern Tennessee, for example, the chief medical examiner's data revealed that nearly all the deaths attributed to suspected overdoses were individuals who died from polysubstance use, opioids in combination with substances like benzodiazepines, marijuana, alcohol, cocaine, methamphetamines, and even other prescribed drugs, and are found in deceased individuals throughout the medical examiner reports for all of Tennessee.
As the number of pain clinics decreased, there was a boom in addiction clinics that emerged in nearly the same regions where the pain clinics closed.
To make matters even more complicated, the United States is seeing an increase in alcohol-related deaths as well as suicides. People struggling with addiction will jump from not just one opioid to another, but from one type of drug to another, according to the autopsy reports, drug courts, and even the addiction specialists.
The availability of stimulants is exploding in Tennessee. For example, as methamphetamines from outside the U.S. are finding their way into the hands of inhabitants.
So, question is, why do we continue to call this an opioid crisis when all along this has always been an issue of polysubstance abuse? Well, in a future program, probably next week, Carmen and I will talk about why do addicts seek any drug.
I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. These now include amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, cancer, Crohn's disease, epilepsy, glaucoma, HIV/AIDS, seizure disorders, chronic muscle spasms, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, PTSD, a terminal condition, as well as other ailments and conditions, including certain diseases with chronic or long-term pain. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We've also set up a website for our Medical Marijuana Society at www.medmarsoc.com. That's www.medmarsoc.com. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. You can also set up an appointment for an office visit to Southside Medical Center right on the website. Again, that website is CompassionateCareJax.com.
HeyDoc.com.
Well, we've come to the end of another Hey Doc show. Carmen and I hope that you've enjoyed the past half hour and have found it interesting, educational, and maybe just a little bit entertaining.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.